Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to another episode of The Last Knock, your horror podcast. As Johnny Numb says, your friends in horror since 2013, which is true. And Johnny Numb's not here. I believe he's napping with his cat. But tonight, thanks to the great Greg Palko of Palko Designs on Twitter, we have a very special guest who I've been waiting to speak to for about 4 months now. But life's been nuts. Now it's settled down. And well, actually, before I tell you about what he has and does, I'm going to get him on right now. Jeremy Wagner, how are you, man?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, thanks for being here. Now, the reason you're on is initially is because Greg Palko, as you know, has an incredible, you know, horror collection. But he said, my collection is shit compared to what Jeremy has. What do you have that makes it so amazing?
Well, I think there's a couple things. Okay. My collection I've been working on for years. Mm-hmm. Really started with some rare stuff from Blackheart, who makes sculptures of, all kinds of horror stuff and all kinds of different sculptures and dioramas, statues, and all this stuff. And so, some from Sideshow Collectibles and that type of thing. But I try to always, I was always into trying to acquire rare stuff. I got one of the first Sideshow pieces that Sideshow ever did was this Bernie Wrightson Frankenstein bust. And,
jeez.
I got one of those, and it's signed by Bernie on the stuff. So that was one of my first major wins.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I was just buying all kinds of stuff, man. You name it. When I talk about horror memorabilia, it's from life-size statues and stuff, like the creature from the Black Lagoon, to little tiny things, old magazines, back issues of Famous Monsters and Fangoria. Nice. So, all this stuff is accumulating into this collection. But as years have gone on, when we talk about Palko and his commentary, holy cow, he thinks his collection pales in comparison. His collection is really awesome, man. His stuff is always top of the line. I love it. Yeah. But he knows some of the other stuff I have. I'll tell you two things about two of my favorite movies, which are The Thing, John Carpenter's version, 1982.
Right.
And Jaws. So I've got my Jaws collection several years ago got more substantial. I met, I became friends with Kirk Hammett of Metallica, between Palko and me, Kirk's got the biggest, horror memorabilia.
Oh, man.
I've seen parts of it, big parts of it, and I know all that he has that I haven't seen in person, but it's very impressive. One thing about Kirk is he's a horror kid, and
right.
I think you're a horror kid, Palko's a horror kid, I'm definitely a horror kid, Kirk's that way, and Kirk was really cool. One time I was at his house, he knows I love Jaws,
right.
So I know a guy who's got the biggest Jaws memorabilia collection in the world. And he's selling off some stuff. So Kirk called this guy, and the guy's like, "Yeah, I've got a few things from the original movie." This guy, it turned out, this guy's dad worked somewhere amongst the cast and crew.
Damn.
And when I say cast, he wasn't in the movie.
Right,
he was more
right.
doing all this kinds of stuff. But the thing about these movies and The Thing as well, I'll get into. Back in the 70s and 80s, people would shoot film, and then when that film was done, they just packed up and left. Memorabilia really wasn't a thing.
Exactly.
And then all of a sudden, years later, people were like, holy shit, I wish I had something from this movie or that. And people that do have that stuff, I'm connected to all the auction sites, Heritage Auction, Prop Store, all this stuff. And they, you'll see stuff pop up from horror movies and every other movie you could think of. Memorabilia is a huge business. So yes. Going back to Jaws, though, unfortunately, there's really, you know, people involved with the movie didn't care about hanging on to props and stuff. Orca or the boat. Some local guy had the orca back while, and then I think decades later, someone's like, hey, we got to get that boat back, dude, to like Universal Studios. And they did. They bought it from the guy who bought it, I think, from the studio at back in the day. They shipped it across the country from Martha's Vineyard to, you know, L.A., yeah. Hollywood. But then it sat in some Universal warehouse, and termites ate the damn thing because no one took it. I mean, how iconic, you know, if that boat was preserved.
Dude. Yeah, yeah.
So it's shit like that. People didn't care. Well, anyway, this guy's his father, and through some sleuthing at himself over the years, acquired some like barrels and pieces, like Richard Dreyfuss's scuba tank. So I was able to get one of the barrels from the orca.
Nice.
And then one of Quint's spears that he screws on the on the spear gun to shoot the barrels into Bruce the shark. And I got one of the crew shirts that Spielberg had made for the cast and crew.
Nice.
So those are like substantial, you know, screen use props.
Yeah, exactly.
Got like every Jaws poster, you know, like the original one sheets, and then all these foreign original one sheets and different jumbo size posters. Really, really cool stuff. There's like a whole Jaws, you know, museum, and then I've got all these Jaws toys. I got the vintage toys, you know, like the shark game where you try to grab the crap out of before the Jaws. You know, stuff like that. So Jaws, and one of the cool things I have is a Jaws original one sheet signed by the entire cast and crew, including Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws.
Damn.
Robert Shaw, which is a hard autograph.
Yeah, because.
So that's pretty cool. So that's it. So I got that Jaws room, and then again, relevant to Palco, talking about my collection. One thing that Palco and I bonded over was obviously our love and passion for horror memorabilia, but the movie The Thing.
Yeah.
He had this really cool, 1:1 scale bust that he showed a picture of one day, and I'm like, holy crap, that's awesome. Where can I get that? Who made that? Because I had a different version. Some guy. So he hooked me up with that guy. And then my thing museum just started growing and growing. And two things happened this last year that really blew up the thing collection. So imagine... And I'll tell you what I'm talking about. But before this last year, imagine just being a guy like me. You're obsessed with the movie, The Thing. And I'm collecting everything there is already. Every horror magazine that ever had The Thing, every Thing statue and toy, all the McFarlane toys, really weird offshoot stuff, anything I could get off of eBay, and then every poster from mm-hmm. every country, on and on. So I bought this item came up. It was really rare, and it was through the Thing tribute page, Outpost 31, which mm-hmm. is the big Thing and everything. And when I bought this item, I connected with the creator of Outpost 31, Todd Cameron, really great guy. And he mm-hmm. was like, hey, man, I'm thinking of parting with most of my Thing collection. Wow. I believe he just moved from Canada. I think he's from Canada, if I got this right. He moved to Florida. And, you know, he's was doing great and just starting a new life. And he's like, I got all this stuff in storage. And, you know, I'd like to sell it to someone who's really going to do something with it. So I'm all about preservation.
Right.
And really putting things on display. And I fortunately had a building up where I reside half the year. I'm from Chicago area, so I got this property up there mm-hmm. That my mom lives on. It's like on 6 acres, and I have this barn that I had remade into this beautiful, almost like gallery quality building. It's really so. I got all this band. I'm in the band Broken Hope, for those who don't know, death mm-hmm. metal band. Going on 30 some years, and my band jams there. I've got a bunch of music memorabilia in there, but I've got a level that's all horror memorabilia. So I got this Thing museum, basically. So Todd, yeah. I acquire a bunch of stuff from him, and then that opened more doors to other stuff coming my way. So now I'm starting to get some real crazy Thing memorabilia. Like, yeah. I'm talking about not just more like rare posters, which I'm really into, and I got this woman stores posters and paper and all this mm-hmm. stuff.
Yeah.
amazing skill, amazing talent to have the stuff she's able to do. So she restores some of that stuff. I get it framed, put it up in the museum. But what happened is I got some stuff from like the set where the Thing was filmed. Now that set was burned to the ground, you know.
Yes.
John Carpenter.
Oh yeah.
But I got, trying to give you a picture of like, I got a display case with these trays, Natural History Museum, right?
Nice.
And these trays have all this debris from like the Outpost 31 shacks and shit that was burned up and whatnot. But one of the crown jewel, dude, is I got the rotor from the Norwegian helicopter that explodes in the beginning of the movie, which is insane. And again, it's like,
damn.
The movie was filmed, they blew shit up, and it was, why, we're out of here, you know?
Yeah,
that shit was down, but people had the wherewithal to go up there, get that stuff. And the great thing is, I'm always trying to make sure it was like definite authenticity, provenance and everything. So all the stuff I got like the actual pictures.
Right.
The guy up there gathering this stuff years ago. He took, you know, during the summer up near Haines, Alaska or whatever.
Yeah, I saw a documentary on it a little bit on there. It's a piece on the new, from Scream Factory, the new Thing collection. Yeah.
Right, correct. Yeah, so that was happening. And then get this, one thing I constantly do since 2011 is I try to educate people that don't know. People think that the 2011 movie, The Thing, that came out was a remake.
It's not.
Prequel.
Yes.
And I thought it was really well done, actually.
Oh, okay.
People you know, had problems with the CGI and whatnot.
Right.
I watched all the behind the scenes stuff after the movie came out on DVD, and I watched all the stuff, interviews and stuff with the guys who put it together before it hit the theaters too. And I know they really strove to honor John Carpenter's vision and marry it up with the Thing 82 that it leads into.
Right.
I enjoyed the movie. So a lot of the CGI aside, the actual practical effects that were done by Amalgamated Design, ADI, they did an awesome job. And so fast forward 2011 to 2018, as I'm doing all this stuff from Ty Cameron and these other places that were opening up, where I was like, I'm just jumping on this awesome, these awesome collections that are available.
Right.
I bought this piece from a guy selling memorabilia online. It was just a foam head of the Thing monster that breaks out of the block of ice in the 2011
right
movie.
Yeah
I'm like, shit, I want that. It was cast from the original mold that ADI created.
Nice.
So when I bought that, that's when, hey, you know, you're really into buying that, you bought it right away. I actually live in, you know, out in Burbank, and I'm friends with Al Gillis and ADI guys, and they're downsizing and looking to sell off a bunch of stuff. I'm like, well,
your timing's always perfect, it seems, man.
Amazing timing on this stuff, dude. Believe me. Yeah. I'm like, wow, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
So, well, I'd like to know what's available. So next thing you know, I'm getting pictures and a list of maquettes that they made.
Yeah.
Then life-size stuff.
Jesus.
So I ended up getting a number of maquettes, storyboard drawings as well, and then some pretty huge shit, man. Like, I got the full-size Thing autopsy. Like, that's on the big, giant table.
Holy shit!
Yeah, I had to have a semi deliver it to that. So I got that. It's funny because when I got the solar large stuff. I'll tell you about with ADI and the guys that, you know, either or coordinate picking up and having this created and everything. And they're like, where the hell do you put this stuff? I'm like, hey, trust me, man. I got this building. You gotta see sometime. It's fitting in there, you know. So had that. If you know it, if anyone checking out your show, you and Palco as well, if you're familiar with the 2011 The Thing movie, at the end of the movie, the actress, she goes on to the actual Thing spacecraft.
Right.
And the original filming showed her in front of this alien pilot who had been, you know, flying the flying saucer. But then in ADI made this really cool thing, and you can see it on YouTube, the Thing alien pilot. It shows how it was made and them filming it and everything. And then Hollywood, of course, who always fucks up everything, they're like, oh, yeah, digitize this CGI thing over this whole thing. And it was like the stupidest looking thing, man, you've ever seen. Like, all these blocks, Tetris moving around and shit. It was, why? I don't understand why you covered it.
I don't get it either.
Long story short, I got that alien pilot that ADI made. So that's the other, that's another one. And then all this other, just a bunch of other stuff from the 2011 movie. So,
damn, man.
Collection. I got the original 82, you know, like the lobby standees.
Yeah, yeah.
That they put from 82. I got a couple of those. And again, this shit's all on display. I wish it was open to the public, but right now.
So do I.
You know, but that's something Palko brought up, man. Greg Palko, he's like, we need to get like Fangoria or some, you know, horror culture site of some type, that could do a series on, you know, memorabilia collections. Primarily horror would be great, but
yeah, sure. Bloody Disgusting, even, you know, Rue Morgue, something.
So, yeah, because this, like, I'm trying to be clear. I'm not trying to hype shit up or anything. This museum's got to be seen to be believed.
I would love to see it, to be honest. I mean, I'm like getting all fanboy over here, and I'm trying to like keep it to a low roar. But your collection's amazing, and you know, there's something important besides the whole memorabilia factor. Is this is historical? You know, this is history. It's movie history. It's horror history.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, and you're preserving that, and that's beautiful. That's fantastic. Because like you said, especially back in the day, things were blown up, destroyed, abandoned, because it was like, it's just a job, it's just a movie. And now, you know, people like really give a damn, not just for the money element, but people care because it's like it was something real.
Yeah, exactly, man. There's stuff that, you know, like that Jaws, you know, crew shirt I got.
Yeah.
It might be trivial to someone, but it's like, wow, someone on the crew was given that by Steven Spielberg. They wore it and, you know, whatever. But it's like, that's a piece of history from that time. I have a few 1982 thing crew jackets, you know, and I got my mannequins and shit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just cool stuff. Another thing I have, not related at all to horror movies, but music memorabilia, is I have this large Jeff Hanneman estate. Jeff Hanneman from Slayer, who unfortunately passed away.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jeff, for me, I have to have a personal connection to stuff too, bro. I don't just, you know,
collect.
I'm into on a certain level, no matter what it is. So the things of Jaws and then all the miscellaneous horror movie memorabilia, music memorabilia that I might have, I really have a connection to. And with the Jeff Hanneman thing, he inspired me at a young age as a guitar player and a lyric writer.
Right.
For me to want to do that, play extreme metal music. And I was always a writer before I was a musician, so I wanted to write lyrics for my band. I could never sing. I could never growl. But I was great at playing guitar, great at writing, and I'm like, wow, one of my favorite guitarists, Jeff Hanneman, not only writes the sickest riffs, he writes the sickest lyrics for the band, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So anyway, long story short, when I got a bunch of Jeff Hanneman's guitars and personal effects and stuff.
Damn.
I made a Jeff Hanneman museum adjoining the thing museum, which is on one end of that building. Jeff Hanneman / Slayer museum is on the other end, and it's the same type of setup where it's a legit museum. I'm talking like, you know, everything from Jeff's shirts and jackets on mannequins to, you know, rare band posters and prints that I had, you know, famous rock photographers personally made for me of Jeff and the band.
Damn.
So I don't know, man. I don't fuck around, you know?
No, you're a historian and a conservationist. That's fantastic.
I like that. I am a conservationist. I'm a curator.
Yes.
I'm all about preservation. I'm talking even down to like Jeff Hanneman's guitars.
Yeah.
there's like little blood specks on there, fake blood specks and different things. And it's like, I don't want to have that shit clean. It's clean. It's all about that preservation, you know? And with the memorabilia, the same thing, going back to what you were saying about having an appreciation, which people have an appreciation for the things they don't have anymore. That's why, like, when all the shit that studios didn't hang on to that are lost to time and history, the things that someone did hang on to, it's more meaningful because we miss the things now that we don't have. And the things we do have, we value greater. For example, right, going back to Kirk Hammett, he's really the biggest horror movie poster collector on the planet. And I'm talking like his posters are some of the most rare horror movie posters in existence. There's like one of two of like the Mummy. This one Mummy poster he has. He's got posters going back to the 30s. Now those, I'm not quite on the level he's at, because those posters, I mean, the pricing and hiring them.
Yeah, that's like a $1 million poster with the Mummy, I think.
Yeah, right, exactly. And when I collect posters for movies I like, I definitely strive to get, you know, of course, originals,
right,
and rare ones and whatnot. And one thing I learned from the Kirk's poster guy, he's a friend of mine, Ron Moore, great guy. He's been collecting posters since he was a child. He just had a passion for it. He made a living out of it, and he's helped Kirk acquire posters all over. Ron's helped me acquire posters too that I've been looking for. And he hooked me up with an opportunity to go back, talking back in time, to get like a vintage movie poster of Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah.
Which always sort of funny movie. I always thought it was cool. And this particular poster is like, I got this poster, the price on it, you'll never find this price. This guy's motivated, I thought of you. And I sound naive because I'm just getting into the poster game, but this is like I know what a one sheet is. There's another style poster that's thin and tall.
Yeah.
And that poster's really rare. For the time period, even one sheets from the time period, you know, 40s, 50s and stuff, are rare. Because back then, like Ron taught me, and if you think about it, it makes sense. You know, there are only a certain amount of movie theaters across the United States when, you know, like parents were kids, you know? So movie companies only made X amount of posters for theaters. And then that certain size poster, like the one I have, you know, they didn't make that many of them. So factors on the rarity, the price being right, you know, I jumped on it. It's a really cool poster. But that's like the oldest poster I have in my collection. But out of all my posters, even those Jaws posters and thing stuff, and the rare posters, that damn Abbott Costello Meet Frankenstein, that's definitely the most expensive one.
It's funny that you mentioned that one, because I remember my mom telling me that she saw it in the theater when it came out when she was a kid, and how they were all screaming and stuff whenever, you know, Dracula came out and Frankenstein, and they were just going nuts. That's very cool, man.
Yeah, my mom actually likes that poster. My mom likes it. I have it hanging in her house, actually.
Damn, man. So, wow. You know, a lot of us, you know, Palco, you know, he collects these amazing, you know, busts and all. And I have a little piece from Starship Troopers of a little, it was a styrofoam leg that was actually part of one of the insects, you know. So I was like, that's like the coolest thing I have. But
dude, that's that ADI did that movie.
Yeah.
Troopers, yeah. Damn. Yeah, are you a fan of the movie?
Oh, I love it, man. I love it.
So that big at the time I was picking up the thing, Autopsy and the Alien Pilots. I say pilots because there's the main one, and then there was like a mummified pilot,
right,
that seen for a microsecond in the movie. But they had remember in Starship Troopers the main, that bug, like the brain bug?
Yeah.
Yeah, they had that, the life-size giant freaking head of that thing on the wall, dude. It's so cool looking.
Damn.
But they weren't parting with that. Dude, that should be on your wall.
I can't even
fill up that hall. I'm looking behind you. Fill up that whole window.
That would be cool as hell, man. I'd never leave home.
Yep.
So is there anything that you have your eyes on now? Something new and wild that you're looking at, or are you just...
Yeah, you know, I'm keeping my... I know of things out there,
mm-hmm,
that people have that have slipped through my fingers. So I'm just biding my time to see when they pop up. And these things do pop up. There's you know, the clapperboard.
Oh yeah.
So the Jaws one is really cool. The originals, that it's got serrated teeth. Yep. You know.
Yeah.
But back years ago, that was at an auction, and it sold for way too much money. I was like, you know, I couldn't dream of getting it. And then now it's like, well, if that popped up again, I'd see if the price came down. It did come up again, but it still went for too much money. So
gotcha.
I'm thinking of that. There's if you think about the end of 1982, the thing where Kurt Russell is confronting the Blair Monster in that ice hallway and shit. That set was also done as a miniature set,
and it looks great.
So something that was available were behind the Blair Monster on the miniature set, a little miniature 55-gallon drums stacked up in frost and shit. And those, like one of those was popped up once, and I swear to God, man, I missed buying it by 30 seconds.
Oh.
Yes. So we'll see, man. You know, stuff like that, the radar is always on. I got to tell you, one cool thing I got, really cool, I just remembered, that wasn't on my radar, but it came up and I freaking jumped on it, was I have the original Universal Studios blueprints for the thing, alien spaceship that crashes.
Oh, man, that's awesome.
And then blueprints for that ice cave at the end of the movie that Kurt Russell is in, and then for like part of the Norwegian camp, you know, that they go visit and shit. So that's just kind of cool. And what I did was I didn't frame the originals. I wanted to keep them rolled up in a blueprint type of
the tubes that they have.
Yeah. But I found this back in Chicago. When I say back in Chicago, by the way, I'm spending winters in Miami Beach, so that's where I'm at right now. So
my smart man.
I'm a snowbird. I'm not an ice and snow guy. I was raised in the wrong climate for my liking. So, but back in Chicagoland, there's this great company I found that does reproductions, large format, from blueprints to, you know, AutoCAD drawings and all this real different type of level shit that you can't get done over at Kinko's. So I took the blueprints there, and they made me these beautiful life-size reproductions. So I got those framed up in that museum, and they're really cool to look at, you know. But one item I just want to tell you that I am also looking for. Remember the poster guy I mentioned, Ron Moore, who finds posters and stuff. He called me one day. He's like, "Look, man, I'm in Hollywood at this collector's house. You got to see some of this stuff that he's got." And this guy, I don't know his name. Ron didn't give me his name. I wish I had it, because maybe you or Palco might have heard of the guy. Next time we talk, maybe I'll find out who he is. But all I know is this guy, the pictures Ron was texting me were like the biggest, for one, like Planet of the Apes collection I've ever seen. Like, I'm talking the old Planet of the Apes, like the full, you know, costumes and wardrobe stuff and whatnot. And
damn.
No, that would be something I collect, but I still thought it was cool. But then the guy has these, so like we, like movies for decades and decades are done in storyboards, right?
People
draw. Well, this guy had these epic fucking glass, imagine a pane of glass painted beautifully with scenes from Willis O'Brien's King Kong.
Holy shit.
Like
the matte paintings?
Yeah, like matte paintings with the monsters and then like the actors and shit. Like,
damn. What the hell?
And he was selling those, but the price was a little steep for me, but one thing popped up, and this is what I'm trying to get at, was this son of a bitch, he had one of the parkas that from The Thing, from the movie The Thing,
right.
And it had, God damn it, it had, I think it was Kurt Russell's parka, but it didn't fit, so Kurt Russell had Keith David wear the parka. So did John Carpenter. Said, "Here, you wear the parka he was going to wear." And by the way, that was Keith David's first film ever.
Yes, it was, yeah.
And then, so this guy had that in his collection with a letter of providence written by Keith David saying, "Yeah, this thing is legit. It's one more on the thing." And that one escaped me too by a day. I told him, I said, I was doing something. I'm like, what's he want for it? It's really expensive. I'm like, fuck, I don't know. I'm like, look, let me get back to you. I got to do something. I'll get back to you by tomorrow. God damn it, he sold it. That guy sold it in like 24 hours.
Oh, man.
So it wasn't public knowledge either. Whoever bought it must have been the next call on the list. So lesson learned, my friend. Some comes across the desk, falls in your lap. It's like, you're not going to see this again. Can you afford it? If you know you can afford it, you're really passionate about it.
Mm-hmm.
And just say, I suggest jump on it, because that's what I learned the hard way. So that's one of the ones to keep my eyes out for. Whoever bought it, they're gonna, hopefully they got who knows, a significant other or someone else is like, why are you collecting this shit? I hear that from my wife. But some other guys might be like, yeah, all right, I'll get rid of it, and then I'll get the phone call. We'll see.
Oh man, I hope so. Well, besides being a horror fan, a passionate collector, curator, conservationist, and all. Established musician. You're also a horror writer as well, correct?
Yep, that's correct. I first, well, earlier in our conversation, I mentioned I've always been a writer before I was a musician. So I started reading at a really young age, like, you know, age three. I was reading, you know, kids' books and then just burning through them and reading at a higher grade level all the time. When I was around five, I think that's when, and this goes back to my love for Jaws. Jaws was in movie theaters. And when it was in theaters, also every freaking newsstand, magazine rack, drugstore, bookstore, and then my mom and all the adults I knew had the paperback edition of Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
It was everywhere. Yeah. And when I saw that cover as a kid, and I told you I'm still a horror kid. I was a horror kid like since I could walk, right?
Yeah.
All that creepy shit, scary stuff, it appealed to me. And, you know, I was just like fascinated by that. So I'm like, I'm going to read what this book's about. And that was the first adult novel I read. And I read that at age five. Now, I've told this story in interviews before, and I haven't, you know, I didn't have a complete grasp of adult situations and certain language. I remember asking my mom, what's this mean? And she'd be like, I don't know if you should be reading that. You know? But my love for books goes back again to being really young. And then not long after I read Jaws, I started writing my own stories. And I still have like my first handwritten stories. That's like, I was like age six and seven and stuff.
Same here.
And it just grew and grew. And I took every writing class I could that was available, you know, junior high and high school, and more Broken Hope. And as I mentioned, I always wanted to write the lyrics for Broken Hope, and the rest, the guys in my band, from day one till now, they're always like, oh, we don't want to write lyrics. Go for it, dude. So I write lyrics. And again, I'm not a singer. Basically, how I've always written lyrics is I write these, they're like micro horror stories, you know, really, you know, really, really savage, really extreme, fucked up, whatever I come up with. And I always, I finish lyrics, turn them into the singer, and then I say, look, man, you're the singer, that's your department. I'm not going to tell you what to sing. Very few occasions I've written lyrics to music and said to a singer, I think this is how it should go with the music. Blah, da, 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 you know, and those few instances, they stuck, which is cool. It's cool to do that. Well, for the most part, I respect our vocalists, you know, for Broken Hope, and I'm like, you make the lyrics fit in what music you want to use them in. So that's how that works. So anyway, through all the years, late teens and 20s, as I'm doing Broken Hope lyrics, I'm still writing short stories, trying to get published. In the 90s, when I was in my mid-20s, I took a stab at writing my first novel, which, big learning curve. Wrote this novel. I thought it was the best friggin' thing in the world. You know? And I had a lot to learn about editing and point of view and all this. But I was really lucky because I had, even though I was publishing lyrics with my band and stuff, it wasn't the same as publishing short fiction or novels in the publishing industry. And I met the right people. I met like an established best-selling author I really loved.
Excellent.
I met this editor who worked on tons of books for like New American Library and Simon & Schuster and all this stuff. And he was went freelance. And then I met an agent who I don't know, saw something in me. She didn't never represented me, but she took me under her wing, gave me guidance, and all the, so all three of these people,
awesome,
one way, shape, or form, collectively, it's like going to, you know, novel writing 101, like going to college. It's great. And that made all that, all those tools and skills and everything that they spelled out for me and really worked on me with, helped shape me as to become a better writer. So fast forward, I finally sold my first short story to St. Martin's Press. They were doing an anthology of zombie stories. And this is a pretty big deal for me because, you know, it's like, holy shit, that's St. Martin's Press. That's a pretty big publisher. And
they're established.
That helped put me on the map. And then right after that, I had already had another novel written, which is The Armageddon Chord. And I got an agent from that story I sold. She represented The Armageddon Chord. That sold to a publisher. And then I was pretty much on my way. Took a while, though, because that first short story came out in 2010 or 9 or something. And then The Armageddon Chord came out like 2011, I believe.
Okay.
2011. Anyway, since then, The Armageddon Chord, when it came out, did really well. It you know, got reviewed in Publishers Weekly, which, you know, for me was a deal because I'm like, holy shit, I can't believe this is like legit, you know?
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you. Rolling Stone reviewed it, and when it came out that first week, it was like number 9 on Barnes & Noble bestseller, paperback bestseller list. And then, so, you know, all that shit was a pretty good launch for me, because I've been working hard for so long. And then I just kept writing. I was started after The Armageddon Chord, I was publishing more short fiction again, left and right. And then I wrote a novel called Rabbit Heart, which came out a couple years ago, and that's gone on to win some really cool awards and stuff. And as I mentioned, I've got a nonfiction book done,
right,
which is a little different for me to do, but and I love writing, and getting out of my comfort zone was fun, you know, as a writer. So that's a book that your followers and anyone listening is not out. It's still being edited, but I've got that. I've got another horror novel done. I published two horror short stories this last year. And one of them is called Norwegian Woods, which is about a black metal band in Norway who take their you know, satanic rites and imagery a little too seriously, and shit goes the wrong way. That came up last year, an anthology called The Big Book of Blasphemy. And I mentioned that because the anthology is really cool. Every story in there personally is, for me, badass. But my story, I'm happy to say, is nominated for a Splatterpunk Award.
Damn.
Short awesome. Story. Well, just being nominated for that's a big deal to me personally. It just makes me go, shit, man, I really love this horror writing stuff. And then, you know, bro, I'm not in it for awards or anything. I'm so passionate about writing. It's like anything that you're passionate about, you should do it because you really love it.
Yep.
That's cliche. I'm not, you know, looking to get awards or, you know, make a living at it. And that stuff happens. That sends me over the moon, believe me. I'm so grateful for it. But again, just being nominated is a big deal. So we'll see in August if how I fare. But anyway,
excellent.
And mentioning the big book of blasphemy and Norwegian Woods, that's the most recent thing I've published. So
excellent, man. Congratulations for all your accolades.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
And, you know, since we're like winding down a little bit, I'm going to ask you that final question that most interviewers on this show hate. Some have good answers, so it's cool. And especially because of you with what you've done with music and writing and as well as collecting, you have a lot to choose from. And you've been on a lot of interviews as well. So what hasn't been asked of you in an interview that you wish had been asked because it's something that you really want to say or share? And now's your chance, man. This is your platform.
Boy, that's a good question. Out of all the interviews I've done, no one's asked me what is something I want to say that hasn't been asked of me before. I really don't know, you know.
Hey, that's fine, man. That's fine if you don't.
You know, I guess one thing that came up today, actually, while I was working on this nonfiction book of mine, which for anyone listening, in short, it's about a famous Michelin star chef who was basically raised in a Hell's Angels type of upbringing and went on to great success as a chef. As I mentioned to you earlier, it's like Sons of Anarchy meets Anthony Bourdain, Kitchen Confidential, you know. And I don't know how I want to put it. Something I read today in the book while I was editing really made me think about you know, passion and, you know, going for things that you love. You know, in my own experience, when I was forming a death metal band, that's all I wanted to do was be in a band and get signed and do all this stuff. And
right.
I came from in the suburbs of Chicago at the time as a teenager in the 80s. Everybody that was in a band around me were in all these cover bands, you know, and they're playing hair metal and, you know, real rock and roll and stuff. And they'd always be like the biggest naysayers, like, what's that you're listening to? It's death metal. What the hell's death metal? It's the most brutal, heavy form of music you'll ever hear, you know? And we're just like, that's garbage, blah, blah, blah. And I never listened to naysayers. I always stuck to my guns. Mm-hmm. And then right after high school, Broken Hope did get signed, and, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah.
Putting out albums and touring, and I'm really proud of those accomplishments. When I was editing this book today, this is relevant to you know, not listening to naysayers and whatnot. You know, this chef that I'm writing about, you know, his own parents and relatives would tell him, you know, he's worthless and he'll never do anything, and you know, he's a piece of garbage. Like, you couldn't belittle or take away a kid's self-esteem more than the way this guy's family did. Hmm. But he found that he loved cooking in home ec class, and he found something. He was fortunate enough to find something in life at a young age that he knew he wanted to do for the rest of his life. And then when he was old enough, as a teenager, he was able to start, you know, legally working a part-time job after school. So he started as a dishwasher in a mom-and-pop restaurant, and then was brought on to do short-order cooking. And then he took, you know, in high school, they have these tech schools that are offered, like, if women at, like, when I was a teenager, it was mostly women. Now it's probably men and women, but cosmetology was the big thing. I remember I dated chicks that went to cosmetology class. And I know I'm the polar opposite of you upstairs here. Man, I'll tell you, having a girlfriend in cosmetology class, I got all the good conditioner that I couldn't afford, you know?
I used to have hair like that, man.
Hey, man, Jack Nicholson said it best. You don't need hair if you have a fucking personality. You know what I'm saying? So, and if this shit was gone, I know I'd like to think I'd still have a personality. But anyway, I digress. The thing with this guy, there was a culinary class available in tech school. So he's working at a restaurant and he's going to tech school and becoming better with his skills as a chef, on and on. And then he gets a scholarship and he follows his dreams and he ends up working for some of the most famous restaurants ever, like Charlie Trotter's in Chicago. And he becomes this James Beard Award winning chef. He becomes a 3 Michelin starred chef over and over and over again. They made a documentary film about the guy. So the moral of my story, when I think about society and people, there's so many people who think up things that I've met. They're like, I'd like to do this sometime. And then you're like, well, go for it. And people will often say, I could never do that.
Yeah.
I can be successful. It's like, you don't know until you try. And people that say you're not going to do it and you suck and shit, like, for me, that just gives me more fire to do what I want, because life is short.
Yeah.
I think everyone, and this is part of what I'm telling listeners here, is I encourage you to do what you want in life, because life is short. And, you know, man, there's a reason why there's a Mick Jagger. There's a reason, you know, there's a President Obama. There's a reason there's a Stephen King and a Steven Spielberg. These are all people that follow their dreams. You know, no magic fairy came down from the heavens and went, poof, you're going to be the president. Poof, you're going to be a best-selling author. Poof, you're going to be a rock star. They all worked to get where they are.
Yeah.
They followed their dreams and worked towards that dream. So that's what I want to leave everyone with, is positive encouragement to follow your dreams. Screw off to anyone that tells you not to, or that you suck, because you can do anything, and I believe it.
Man, that's beautiful, man. I used to teach, and you should be in the classroom, man. I'm serious.
I love to encourage people, everybody, and I especially love to encourage young people, you know, when it comes to not just following your dreams, but, you know, things that I'm passionate about, you know, writing, playing an instrument, that type of thing, you know, that's important to me. You know, so people talk about paying it forward.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned to you, you know, I had these wonderful people in my life, whether it was my grade school librarian, Mrs. Lee Byrne, I'll never forget her, who said, when I was in first grade, you really love books. You're really talented with these little stories you write. I want to bring you into a class with older students in sixth grade and have you be a part of this group.
Nice.
Surrounded by older kids that are passionate and about what they're doing, and they're doing what you're doing now, you know, whatever, 5-6 grades ahead of me. That was cool. And then again, that literary agent, that editor, and that best-selling author, those are people who many people, you know, won't give a young person or anyone the time of day because they think they're too good, or it's them or something, successful people and whatnot. And that's really shitty. But I was fortunate, and I've had that kind of rejection from people, you know, going through my various phases of being a writer, even being a musician, you know, trying to get a booking agent or tours or whatever. You get a lot of people that say, I'm not going to help you. I'm not interested in what you're doing or whatever. But again, those few people that I was fortunate enough to cross paths with that really, again, took me under their wing, gave me guidance and encouragement, and gave me the tools, again, and the skills that I wasn't aware of.
Right.
But I learned that I needed to be better at my craft of writing. I'll never forget them. So it's in the spirit of what they did for me that I like to pay it forward and help other people, you know, who are passionate about, again, writing, playing an instrument, or really doing anything. Man, I'm the king of pep talks. And, you know, I'm a bit sentimental. And I don't forget where I came from.
That's
where I'm at, you know.
It's funny that you mentioned your first grade teacher. Mine was Ms. McKelvey, and she told me, "Hey, Bill, you're a great writer. Why don't you write?"
And oh, wow.
That was it, you know.
Wow, that's awesome, man.
Yeah,
that's so great.
Thank you, Jeremy. Why don't you tell people where they could find stuff about you, your books, your music, all of it, man?
Sure. There's I have an official website. It needs to be updated, but most of everything about me is on there. It's jeremy-wagner.com, jeremy-wagner. And then if you're on Instagram or Twitter, I got the same handle, Jeremy X Wagner. And then I have an author official page. I think it's Jeremy X Wagner official or something, but I'm easy to find.
That's excellent. And, you know, I'm going to sign off in a second. But before I do, people, you could find this show, The Last Knock, on Spotify as well as iTunes and at CrashPalaceProductions.com, which also has horror articles as well from wonderful people. And you can follow me on Twitter at Crash Palace. But Jeremy, the door is always open to you, man. You ever want to come back on the show for anything? Got a new book coming out, stuff for your band, whatever. Just, you know,
Thank you.
Bill, I want to come on.
Hey, man, I've had a great time talking to you. You know, I haven't done an interview in some time. Back when my last book came out. Again, it's been, I think, going on 2 years when Rabbit Heart came out. So I was doing a lot of press then. So I told you before we started the show today that once I get talking about stuff I'm passionate about, I'm kind of a motor mouth. So for me, it's real fun to revisit conversation talking about horror collections and music and writing and everything. So thank you. It's been a great time.
Thank you, and I'm glad you enjoyed it, and hopefully we'll see you again in the very near future.
Yeah, sounds good. And before I go, I want to leave you with something coincidental I got today. You mentioned Last Knock. That's the name of your show, correct?
Yep, absolutely.
So I want to share this text I got. This guy didn't even know I was going to be on your show, so I want to be up front, but it's very coincidental and irrelevant and cool, I think. But he said, check this out. And it's a meme, and it says, "Knock is the world's shortest horror story with only two sentences. Quote, the last man on earth sat alone in a room. There was a knock at the door."
That's where we got our show from, the show title.
Shit. That was texted to me at 7:56. And you know, I don't hope you're not insulted. I was thinking the name of your damn show was Crash Palace. So when you said Last Knock, I'm like, holy cow. Now tell me the universe ain't talking to you and me, Bill.
Hey, that's fine, man.
That's pretty freaking cool.
Yeah, I love it.
Awesome.
All right, thanks a lot, man. Have a good one.
Yeah, you too. Thanks again. Take care.
Anytime. Bye.
Bye.